Welcome to Executives After Hours, real conversations with real leaders. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. I want to make you a promise that over the next 60 minutes, you will learn at a minimum two things. One, every leader and executive makes mistakes on the way to the top. And two, and more importantly, everyone has a unique story to tell. And that's what we do here on Executive After Hours. We sit down with leaders across a variety of industries, and we talk to them about their unique story. So welcome to the community, and stay tuned for today's episode on your Executives After Hours.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Executive After Hours. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. So today's episode is with the famous or infamous, depends on where you want to fall on the continuum, Miss Deb Gabor. Deb is the CEO of Soul Marketing, and more importantly, she is the author of the very much provocative book, Branding is Sex. There's actually nothing provocative about it except for the title, but Deb loves branding. And so Deb and I have an awesome conversation about her upbringing, about kind of her life, her divorce, her direction, her dating life, all of which is entertaining. And in this week, which is super awesome, is that you've got two back-to-back guests this week that are super authentic. And for me, that's everything. That's life. So today's episode is Miss Deb Gabor. Also, please leave a review on iTunes and subscribe. And finally, I want to say thank you to my content partner, C-Suite Radio, as well as Engage Me Online Magazine. And then finally, for any of those looking for speaking, I'd love to get you to book me to talk about my new book on authentic leadership. I've got a fantastic model that I think anyone or everyone will be interested in. So reach out to me at james@drjameskelly.com. It's spelled K-E-L-L-E-Y. All right, everyone. Have an awesome Monday. See you.
But I do want to go back to the Midwest thing. Where were you from in the Midwest?
Cincinnati, Ohio. Have you heard of it?
I went to school at University of Dayton, so yes.
Okay, so I went to Miami.
Ah, you were one of them. In fact, here's a true story. This is so true. Highly illegal, but it's all right. This was like 25 years ago.
Are we recording right now while we're talking about this?
Yes, totally. This is how I roll, Deb. I just jump right in.
So me too.
I don't have some big elaborate like bum bum bum. I don't do any of that. So I remember it was one night. It was about 11 o'clock at night, and one of my roommate's brother, sister, and brother went to Miami, Ohio, and he was like, "You got to get the turkey gobbler." We're like, "What's a turkey gobbler?"
It's like, God, it's the turkey sandwich with the banana peppers and the provolone cheese and the mayonnaise. Yes.
So we got in three cars, 12 of us. Each car had a case of beer. Totally illegal. Fully got it. One person was designated driver in each car, so that was the safety zone. And we drove all the way there for us to get a turkey gobbler. And then we turned around and drove all the way back home after that. And I will tell you, I was slightly disappointed. I wasn't happy about it. It was a very long drive.
Wow.
Yeah. So.
You drove all the way there for that sandwich?
Correct.
That was ridiculous. It. Okay. Yeah. So, and the fun thing about the turkey gobbler sandwich, the reason why it was so popular was because they would deliver it to you in the middle of the night. So the fact that you drove to Oxford, Ohio to eat a turkey gobbler sandwich at a restaurant that doesn't even really have a brick and mortar location seems completely ridiculous, but totally not out of the realm of possibility. Correct. Of stupid college students.
So
been
did
there,
you,
done that.
Did
so,
you ever
yeah.
go to, did you ever go to Dayton to hang out? Because it was far more exciting than Miami.
Why would I have gone to Dayton to hang out?
Because you're from Cincinnati. Like, you weren't that far away. You had to have friends who went to UD from there.
We had friends, but they came to Cincinnati, or we like all went to Chicago because that's what we did. We got in the car. We would rather drive 6 hours over I-65 than the 40 minutes it took to get to Dayton, which, by the way, the armpit of the universe. It's so funny because I have a college age daughter that she goes to the University of Oklahoma, which is really, really unpopular among the people living here in Austin, Texas, as you can probably imagine, home of the Longhorns. However, during the senior year when we were going all over the country, and she was hotly recruited as a musical theater major. Believe it or don't, it's a lot like Division I sports recruiting. We went to a bunch of schools in Ohio. Surprisingly, Southern Ohio is a hotbed for great musical theater talent. Cincinnati Conservatory of Music, Wright State University, like Baldwin Wallace up in Cleveland, just a bunch of random places like that. So we were all over Ohio multiple times. My daughter was like, oh, this is a really good place to be from, but I can't go to school here. But we went back and forth to Ohio many times. We flew in and out of that Dayton airport several times. And on one particular trip in the dead of winter, she asked me, Mommy, please, I beg of you, please don't make me go to school here. I can't stand this. So
she gets anyway, spoiled that's by how the she sun. Ended up.
Exactly. She's a total sun baby.
So how does one go from Miami of Ohio to where? Like, because your family's from Cincinnati. So I always have to say, I said I wasn't going to say this in this podcast, but it always rings more true to people from the Midwest. So having interviewed quite a few people, one of the things that I always enjoy is kind of learning about your family growing up, right? Mm-hmm. Brothers, sisters, mom and dad. But what I've always seemed to find fairly consistently is that if people were raised in the Midwest, they had the most boring upbringing because it was so healthy and somewhat normal across. So
you're kind of right. Yeah. The interesting thing is my mom was born and raised in Cincinnati, and her parents also, or her mom, my grandmother on my mother's side, her name was Henrietta, and we called her grandma, but my grandfather, who we called Captain, was from a really, really bad part of Chicago, and was known to be a friend and or employee of Al Capone, which is kind of interesting. My father's side of the family is far more interesting. I'm first generation born American on my father's side of the family. So the Gabor side of my family, my dad and my grandmother and grandfather were from Hungary, and my grandmother and grandfather are Holocaust survivors. My grandmother is 100 years old.
That's
and
awesome.
Living in, she's awesome. Living in Southern California, she is California's oldest surviving Holocaust survivor, which is really, really interesting. So I had this interesting and quite boring upbringing where I had, you know, the foreigners on one side and then sort of the old school Midwesterner on the other.
Midwest Catholic, right? Was that Catholic?
No. We're Jewish. Like,
oh, wow.
Yeah. So, and there's a lot of Hungarian Jews in Southern Ohio, in Dayton and Cincinnati. And so that's how it came to pass that my father's family ended up there. Cause everybody comes through New York, right? And then they end up there. So I was born in Cincinnati, but pretty soon after I was born, when I was still a toddler, my parents moved us to the East Coast, I think for my dad's job. And so I lived in New York City, I lived in New Jersey, and then we moved back to Cincinnati, and that's where I did my formative years.
And
I have a little brother. Sorry.
What did your dad do? It sounds like packaged goods, maybe?
I wish then I would have had a connection there, but then, you know, I wouldn't be doing this fabulous job that I do now. Because I could have just gone straight into P&G. Yeah. No, my father worked in the telecommunication industry, and he kind of went back and forth when it was still kind of a regulated monopoly in the Bell system.
Yeah.
He kind of rotated back and forth through Cincinnati Bell and AT&T and, you know, 9X and those companies and things like that. So he did that. He also is trained, I'll say, because I think it's a vocation, as an attorney. And later in life, after he retired from his job at the phone company, he started practicing law, and he was defended the dregs of humanity against violations of their due process because he believes in the American justice system and the American way.
That is awesome. So, did you ever talk to your grandma about her experience?
Sure. Absolutely. So I have talked to her about lots of experiences. I got a great story for you, which is more recently talking about her experiences. So the last time that I visited in California, my dad said, hey, ask your grandmother about her last doctor visit. So I was like, all right, I'm game. So I asked her, I call her Bubby, and I said, so Bubby, tell me a little bit about your last doctor visit. And she has this great Hungarian accent. I mean, she's so charming, and she's only about 3 feet tall. She's like a total pocket grandma. Stick her in your pocket. And she says to me, she says, "Oh, Debbie, my doctor appointment, it was so good. I'm in such great shape. I don't even need eyeglasses." So she goes on and she tells me this. My father leaves the room and she says to me, she kind of leans in real close and she says to me, "Debbie, do you know this stuff? You put it in a paper and you light it on fire and you smoke it and it makes you feel euphoric." And I said, "Are you talking about marijuana?" And she goes, "Yes, I think that is what this is called. When I was in the work camps back in Hungary, we used to take the chamomile tea and we would put it in the paper and roll it up and then light the end of it." And she said, "We'd smoke it and make us feel euphoric." She said, "I heard that there's something like that here in California and I can probably get that." Just as my grandmother is basically confessing to me at 100 years old that she wants a script for pot, my father enters the room and he's like, "Is she asking you for a script for pot?" And I said, "Yes, she is. Why don't you get her one?" Yeah. And he said, "Well, you know what? I don't really want her to smoke anything." And I said, "Well, have you talked to the doctor about her smoking it?" And he said, "Yeah, I've talked to the doctor about her smoking cigarettes." So she smokes like 2 or 3 cigarettes a day or something and has been doing it for 100 years, yeah, right? And she's still kicking it. So my father asked the doctor, "Well, can you make my mother stop smoking?" The doctor says, "Mr. Gabor, I'm very much out of my element here. I've never had a patient this old, let alone one that smokes. Whatever she's doing, have her continue doing it." So I encourage my father.
And at this point, who really cares, right? Like, she's 100, so let her just go. Whatever she wants to do.
If she wants to, like, you know, take a snort off a bottle of whiskey 3 times a day too, like, have at it. I mean, she's in great health. So it's so funny. And I need to check in with her and see if she ever got her script, because it is popular, but it's so funny. You know, she's like, "What is this stuff? You roll it up in paper and you smoke it. It makes you euphoric." So there you go. That's my 100-year-old grandmother called
that
Bucky.
That is fantastic. So we jumped ship. So I was actually looking more for, like, not that your grandma smokes pot, but, or wants to smoke pot.
But we don't know if she does or not. I mean, that's
true.
Like, that's
she
the
wants
next
to.
Show. You should have her. You should have her on your show.
but more importantly, like, did she ever talk to you about the Holocaust, though?
Well, sure. So the interesting thing about this is my grandmother would talk about it, and she would talk about it a lot. And she tells this story of how she and my infant father were actually being holed up in the basement of a German soldier's house. So, you know, the German soldiers came in and they occupied a lot of the nicer homes in the town that my mm-hmm. family lived in outside of Budapest. And so she talks a lot about that experience. She also, and maybe she hasn't done this in a couple of years, but she also used to go to schools around her, both when she lived in Ohio and then since when she's moved to California. She would go to elementary schools and talk to the kids mm-hmm. about the experience. And
it she was, enjoy it, that?
Yeah, very much. You know, she would go and she would connect with the kids and she would tell them about the experience and just answer, like, whatever questions they had. It was sort of like a Reddit ask me anything for mm-hmm. a really, really old lady and a bunch of kids, right? And the kids would really enjoy it, and she really enjoyed it, and she loved connecting with the children. Yeah. But one of my favorite things about that was when I would visit her, she would show me these giant stacks of letters that she would receive from these elementary school kids, that they would have drawings and they were thank you notes, or, you know, they were poems or something like that. And, you know, they were very thoughtful, and children just don't see color. They don't see race,
they're awesome.
They don't see ethnicity in the same way that adults do, because they just haven't been spoiled by that. But just the innocence of it is really, really beautiful. And then every once in a while, there's something thrown in there, like, "Dear Mrs. Gabor, thank you for coming and teaching us about Hitler and the Holocaust. That is a really kick-ass necklace you were wearing. Where can I get one like that?" So, you know, just I love the humanity of it, and I admire her for that.
So growing up in that, did that give you a really, 'cause I would imagine hearing these stories of this horrific event, did it give you a sense of your, like, a strong sense of your history? And did that impact who you were as a person?
So the strange thing is that my father, I believe, was so traumatized by the events of his childhood. So not only like this Holocaust stuff, which he really doesn't remember because he was an infant, but after the family was reunited in Hungary, the communists came in and invaded. And their family tried many, many times to escape from Hungary. And there were work camps and occupations and all of that kind of stuff happening at that time. And I know that it was a really, really scary time from what my grandmother and my grandfather had told me. My father doesn't talk about it at all. In fact, I think he was so traumatized by it that he either doesn't admit to, or he has kind of sublimated all of his memories about those events. So while I have a really, really strong sense of identity and self, you know, with this Eastern European Jewish culture, I don't know a lot of the specifics because it wasn't part of the lore that was handed down from generation to generation in my family.
You kind of have like your own identity detached from that. You know what I mean? Like,
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So I mean, that makes sense.
My parents have often said, like, I don't know where you came from. Like, you're a complete anomaly, and we're left scratching our head. We have nothing to say about that. No, people have told me my entire life that I'm a truly singular human being and that they've never met anyone like me. And I embrace that, but I know that that comes from a combination of the, a combination of the Midwest upbringing and, you know, sort of this squeaky, clean Midwestern sensibility crossed with, you know, this Eastern European kind of worldly Jewish tradition.
So where did you go after Miami of Ohio? Like what, I mean, not that I want to go through job by job and hour by hour, but like, you know, how did you get to owning Soul Marketing, I guess?
So after I went to school at Miami, I worked at a TV station in Cincinnati and it was kind of a dead end job.
Did you want to be like on air or was it behind the scenes?
Well, the job was mostly behind the scenes. So I was running the assignment desk mostly in the middle of the night. And when I did go out and do remote reporting, or if I was carrying things, usually like big reels of cable and cameras and things like that, it was for stuff like apartment fires and shootings and stuff like that. Because, you know, nothing good ever happens after midnight in Cincinnati, Ohio. And it didn't pay a lot. It was a very, very thankless job. And I was basically working for free. And then I had this opportunity for like a really, really nice corporate job in Chicago, and all my friends and sorority sisters and the boy I liked, they all had moved to Chicago. Because if you're from Cincinnati and you go to Miami University, you either go back home. So like if you came from New York, you go to New York.
Or you go to Chicago. And that's what we did in Dayton.
To Chicago.
What year were you in Chicago?
I got there in late 1990, showing my age. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Where did you live in Chicago?
Okay, so here we go. This is where we do the dance of the intersections. Lakeshore and Belmont, Halsted and Webster, Harlem and Higgins.
Holy
yeah,
crap.
I have really, I you know what, I also have committed to memory every credit card number I've ever had. Rain Man. And then I spent one just horrific year in the suburbs and then moved back to the city. And then I was living like sort of between Park Ridge and Norwood.
So how many years?
I guess like almost 9 years.
So Chicago, I was only in Chicago 10 months. So I was kind of not forced to move, but personal stuff got me out of there. And, but that was like to this day, I was a block from Wrigley Field. And to this day, it was one of my favorite. I was dirt poor. I mean, dirt poor.
Me too. Ooh. At the beginning, those, like I always refer to those as the salad days. I'm like, man, I was so poor and I was so happy and so uncomplicated.
I remember there was this hamburger restaurant around the corner from our house. And my roommate and I would search the couches for change. If we got to $2, it was a hamburger. And we were so excited about that. That was
I
like,
remember those days.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
But Chicago is just one of these cities that it's easy to fall in love with because it's just – the people are so great. The city is so manageable when you live downtown.
Oh, yeah.
God, it was just such a great place to live.
I loved it. I loved it. Yeah.
Did you hate moving away from there? Because did you go from there to Austin?
I did go from there to Austin. I didn't hate moving away from there. It was time for me to go sow my wild oats someplace else. And I got to Austin just about the time Austin was really becoming Austin. Mm-hmm. And my younger brother was here and he was getting his PhD at the University of Texas. And I came here on a boondoggle because I had accepted another a boondoggle. Well, yeah. That's where I got recruited for a job in Austin when I already had had another job offer in Chicago that I had taken. Yeah, this is awesome. A little dishonesty on my part, but no, the job that I was offered in Chicago, which is really funny, I had been working for a tech startup actually, and I got recruited by Morgan Stanley. Morgan Stanley, they came to me. They're like, "Do you know what the internet is?" I said, "Yeah, I think I've heard of it." They said, "We think people are going to trade stocks on that. We need someone to run that." And I thought, "Huh, that sounds cool. Let's do that." So I had accepted the job, but hadn't started. I was in that little gardening period. Yeah. The British call it, between, you know, leaving one job and taking the next. And then I got called on this opportunity in Austin, Texas. And I thought, well, my brother lives there. He says it's great. It's a free trip to Austin. What the heck? And I threw up my hands and got on an airplane. And lo and behold, I fell in love with Austin. I especially fell in love with the real estate prices in Austin because I lived in my, you know, my teeny tiny house on a postage stamp size lot in Chicago, and I could get like what was sort of like a mansion, you know, real close to the city in Austin for relatively less money. So, and I loved the company and I loved the opportunity and I loved the vibe and just the feeling of Austin. So I got here sort of in the go-go days of Austin and really never looked back.
So that was like late 90s probably, give or take?
Yeah, 1998. So I've been in Austin. I'm like 19 years,
almost
which is,
20. Wow.
Which is, yeah, it's a lifetime because it's longest I've lived in any one place, and I truly call it home.
Yeah. So what was the job you took down there?
So I went to work for a company that did market research, brand-focused market research in the technology industry, and it was my first agency job. So previously I had been on the, you know, we call it the client side of the business, and it was my first client-facing job on the agency side, and I was running a research practice, so brand research practitioners, and they brought me on with the sole purpose there to teach researchers how to speak the language of marketing and speak the language of branding and strategy, so that they could be of far more value to their clients. And so I ended up, you know, running a syndicated research practice and you know, kind of moving up through the ranks of that company. It was very fortuitous because the guy who hired me out of Chicago to bring me to Austin to work for that company, he went on to be the founder of like a really awesome Austin company called HomeAway. And when he was entrepreneur in residence at Austin Ventures, which was backing HomeAway before it was even HomeAway, he hired me and was basically, he hired me, you know, when I had left my agency jobs and gone on to hang a shingle and just do the stuff that I was going to do. He hired me he was a very, very early client to me, and he's sort of at the top of my business tree, which is kind of fun.
So this little journey that you've been going on so far in your life, do you credit anyone for nudging you in directions, or do you just kind of think these are whimsical choices that you made that worked out?
Oh my God. Nothing I do is on a whim. I don't know what personality type this is, but I am very oriented towards making decisions, right?
Type A?
There's that. When faced with choices, it's really easy for me to decide. And
easy to decide? Like, you don't think about it? It's just, it's clear to you it's black and white? Or do you mean you like weigh up the pros and cons and then you decide? Like, what do you mean by that?
Well, I weigh up the pros and cons, and I usually can come through with a pretty clear picture directionally where I'm supposed to go. So I know a lot of people in my life who are just like paralyzed by analyzing all kinds of decisions. I'm just oriented towards like make a decision and go. Now, I will take in all of the information and I will consider it and I will weigh my options, and decisions I make are pretty thoroughly researched, but I'm usually comfortable with my decisions because I feel like I have a great gut.
Have you been like that?
Oh yeah, definitely.
So where does that come from? Was your dad like that? Because your dad wanted to be a lawyer, so in his second life, like, that might be some organized skills. Was your mom, did she work at a home? Or I feel like Cincinnati, in my head, the mom would work at home, but I could be totally wrong on that.
My mom was a CPA with a thriving practice of her own.
Totally wrong. So that's where you got it, maybe, right?
Yeah, I think so. So my mom died when I was pretty young. She died when I was a senior at Miami. So I was like 20 years old. And
can I ask what she died of?
She had a really rare form of cancer that only like 4 in 1 million people get. And unfortunately, there's not a lot of research and there's not a lot of treatment options and stuff. So I think she was terminal from the time that she was diagnosed. And it was very sad because we were really close. But I do believe that as a young person, I was very much impacted by her way. She just was very fast on her feet, really, really smart. I understand she was the first female engineering student at the University of Cincinnati. And then she went on to, go to business school and study accounting and then become a CPA and all that kind of stuff. So I feel like I get all, it's not that my father isn't driven. I mean, this is a man who came to the United States when he was like 18, learned English in 6 months and then went to college, you know? So both my parents were just like extremely driven.
Traits. So
yeah.
So I get the. So I just want to back up and talk about your mom because my dad died when I was at university as well.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, it's such a long time. It's so funny because people say that, and it's probably why I didn't say I'm sorry to you. By the way, it's like it was so long ago. Like, you know, at some point, like I don't know. For me, is there a limit of the I'm sorry's? I don't know. Like in my head, I'm like, why would you say I'm sorry? I know it's the polite thing to do, but it was 20 years ago.
I have a kid right now who's about the age that I was when my mom died.
Yeah.
And we have this incredible connection. We are deeply, deeply connected in a way that my mother and I was. And so I think I very much look at it from the point of view of, what if I were her and I were this age and I was losing my mom?
So let me ask you then, because was it first semester, second semester, summer?
It actually was between first and second semester. It was over Christmas break.
Jesus. Because I remember.
Yeah, it was horrible.
So for me, the way I dealt with it is I drank a lot for a semester. Mm-hmm. So as you are a self-proclaimed, or maybe I gave you the title, type A, you know, did that almost make you focus more to get out as a coping mechanism?
Kind of. Yeah. So I think I coped pretty well. I only had like one class that I really whiffed that next semester. And it wasn't even a super hard class. It was this, I want to say it was like film evaluation or film critique or something like that. And I just didn't want to watch the movies. Yeah. I had a really, really short attention span, you know? And so that was the only thing. I went and I saw that professor and I said, you know what? I don't want to drop this class. I'm going to graduate in May. I need this class, but I also don't want to do the work. What can we work out? You know? And I used the, my mom just died card and I'm kind of a hot mess right now and whatever. And thankfully, I mean, he was very kind. I don't remember what we actually worked out. Yeah. I actually did analysis of television commercials because that's all my attention span could handle was, you know, like 30 or 60 second television commercials.
So wait, you just said you didn't really like have any difficulties like from a focus standpoint, like you were able to focus on school and like you were able to block it all out.
Just it's weird how it all sort of manifested in this one class. Does that make sense?
A lot
of stuff like that goes like that in my life where it like all comes out in one place. Or
because it sounds like, you know, as the way you describe it is that because I don't want to say that's a fluff class because I'm sure someone in my audience listens.
It was fluffy. It was pretty fluffy. Yeah.
But like. You know, I don't know. Like, did you ever have a chance to go? So, like, I guess I think of it like this. So, my dad died when he was 49. How old was your mom?
46. So younger than I am now.
Okay. So for me, 49 is like my D-Day.
I had that too. I'm like, if I make it past 46, I'm living for freaking ever.
So
you know?
So I kind of have two questions. One is, how did you cope? Because you can't say that just you one class is how you cope. Like I fluffed off one class. That doesn't unless you just are really good at compartmentalizing stuff. Mm-hmm. Second question is, how did you feel about 46? Because this really is like you know, my dad had high blood pressure. He had asthma. He was overweight. Whatever. He had congestive heart failure. So every time I go to the doctor, my blood pressure is right on the cusp. And, he had psoriasis. I have psoriasis. I'm like, oh, I have psoriasis. Great. That's also linked to this and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, great. I'm dead at 49.
Right. Oh, so God. Like, wow.
I go through all of the negative conversations, but I'm super healthy. I eat really healthy. I work out every day. All of the other things that are really important. But in my head, I've got this tick, 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 tick. And so now I'm so driven to get someplace by 49 that I don't really know what I'm going to do when I hit 50.
I see what you're asking me. So, I'll say yes, her death impacted me. I didn't realize it until much, much later. I'm really good at compartmentalizing things. And so I compartmentalized for a really long time and I was like, I just got to plow through. So my mother was the person that when she was at the very, very end of her life, and it was very clear she was going to die at home in the bed. I mean, she had like the hospital bed and hospice was there and, you know, it was going to happen any moment kind of thing. She had her calendar. This was, I guess, December or January. She had her calendar marked out with like tax season appointments all the way through April. And she very much was like, I'm going to plow through. And she was meeting with clients until like the bitter end.
Clients, like, what are you like? I would be like, it's all right, man. I'll find someone else. Just take a break. You know,
so this is, it's really interesting that you asked that. So those clients, a lot of those clients were people who were just really, really close to her, where she had, you know, sort of deep emotional connections and bonds with those clients, much in the way that I have deep emotional connections and bonds with my clients. And I think I learned that from her. And so, you know, so my mom was very much of the state of mind. She's like, yeah, I'm probably not going to make it very long. Here's the deal. You got to press on. You got a lot of stuff to do. You need to finish this college degree and then you need to go and make some shit out of yourself because, you know, you were put on this earth to do something great. So go out there and do it. And so like, I just sort of like plowed through it. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting to me though, that what I learned through that experience is that yeah, my mom was awesome and she was very much a force of nature. My father, even more so. So, you know, my dad was very much when I was growing up sort of dad in absentia because, you know, he was traveling around and being, you know, business executive and all that kind of stuff. And my mom was, you know, making stuff work and we, you know, kept everything sort of all of the plates were spinning at the same time. And my brother and I were just very, very busy, involved, engaged children mm-hmm. and young adults. And then what I learned of my dad was, you know, he was kind of the primary caregiver when my mother was sick. And when she was sick, she was really sick. We're talking radiation, chemotherapy, mm-hmm. you know, for 3 years or something. And he was very, very devoted to her. And then a couple of years ago, so, you know, fast forward to about 2013, my father has this amazing bicycle accident where he had every injury you could ever imagine, none of which you're supposed to survive. Everything from a torn aorta to a ruptured spleen to ruptured kidney, broken back, broken pelvis, broken leg, et cetera, on life support, literally for weeks. You know, when he wakes up, they take the tubes out. His vocal cords are paralyzed. He doesn't have a voice. He has to get a tracheotomy, all this kind of stuff. The dude is up and like doing it. He's, you know, he really, really showed himself to be a force nature. So I think that I have that just innate sense of mm-hmm. just drive and make decisions and get stuff done and move forward. It comes from both my parents. And then I also, you know, really the motivating factor for me, how I got to the place that I am in my life and my career, it came from being divorced when my child was very young and, you know, being involved in like just a hideous marriage with a really, really bad ending. And then having it come very much into full view that I was going to need to figure out a way to make lots of money, have the flexibility I needed to be a single parent without another parent involved, and be able to pay my own way and create just an amazing space and life for my kid. And that really is what has driven me, is just this, I don't want to rely on anybody else for help.
And so is that a manifestation of the marriage where you felt, I don't know if you felt like you were overly dependent on him and the outcome
no.
was?
Okay. No. I was not dependent
on
him.
I like how you chuckle at that, by the way.
Well, yeah. I mean, this is a man who contributed nothing financially to our relationship. I mean, he was incapacitated by alcohol abuse and drug abuse. And I believe still is. Like, no one has seen hide nor hair of him, like, probably for 14, 15 years. So
God, that could be my brother.
Isn't it? It's so interesting how people just fall off the radar. But, you know, there's a lot of shame. There's a lot of mental illness on his part.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's a whole slew.
Yeah. I mean, that's like a whole other podcast for another day. But
oh, no, that is my podcast, Deb. That is it. Like, learning this stuff about you is what's awesome about what I do, because you probably go on 1,000 podcasts and you talk about soul marketing in your book and, you know, all this. But for me, These stories are what makes Deb Deb, not what
That's
you
true.
Do is the culmination of your experiences.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I didn't get this answer from you about when you were 46 and, you know, for me, I have the panic button, like it's actually on my side table, it's a little red button. I'm just going to push it at 49 and see what happens. For you, that might've been a dramatic visualization, slightly over.
I know, but I love it. It was amazing. I totally, you know, pictures of words. I mean, that's what I do for a living, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and it's like, oh, I totally got that image. It's a great story.
And so at 46 is, I mean, did you even have time to stop and care about, meaning like your own mortality at 46, because you had this daughter that you were basically having to take care of?
I have not stopped to think about that maybe ever. I'm going to knock on something that is either of wood or particle board standing here in my office at this point. But I, you know,
particle
board. I mean, I'm sure there's something made by IKEA here in my office, like a flurgen of some kind. Yeah. I need to knock on.
I think it's called a flug-a-flurgen.
Flug-a-flurgen. Yeah. So I just knocked on a flug-a-flurgen. Yeah. But, you know, I am grateful to be in amazing health and be very, I'm very healthy. I have a lot of vitality. I have what seems like endless amounts of energy. I have a lot of really, really old age in my family, which in my mind kind of cancels out the early death of my mother to some extent. So I'm not driven by that fear of my own mortality.
Good for you. And let me rephrase this, though.
Think about that.
So let me rephrase. I don't fear dying. So my mom is petrified by dying. I can't. She's 73, smokes a pack of cigarettes a day, been doing it since 16, overweight, high blood pressure, poor thyroid. She is a walking medical disaster on every ounce of definition. And, she will not talk about at all death. Where I'm like, you're going to die, so let's talk about it.
Oh, yeah. You as know? Sure as the sun will rise and set today, you're destined. People always say, like, oh, it can't kill you. And, you know, I said, it's certain that you're going to die. We're all just doing it at different rates,
totally.
Right?
Some are overachievers, get it done soon. Some take the long game, like the tortoise. So tomato, tomato, really. All right. So you have this crappy marriage. You raise this daughter. What were the challenges? Like, did you feel this external pressure? I always wonder this as a single mom because, you know, it's funny. We're just dealing with this with our kids now. So I have four kids.
Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of kids. It's like a flock.
Well, five's a flock. This is just this is just a gaggle.
True. You can't field like an all kid basketball team.
Correct.
You need one more.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. Badminton, we're good, but and so, you know, like I'm always the disciplinarian in the house, almost always, for sure. you know, and she's like just a loving, caring mom. And so like
good cop, bad cop. I love it.
Yeah. Steps. Yeah. Long-term psychological damage, short-term psychological damage. So, how did you balance that out? And I'm sure it's a question I get all the time, and grow a business and write a book, you know, be a mom, an all-star mom. Like how are you able to play all those different roles? Did you have support or help around you?
No, not really. I'm this lone outpost. And I'm not kidding. Yeah. I'm
what about your brother? Is he in Austin still?
No. He's in Los Angeles. He's busy being a rocket scientist. You know, we overlapped each other in Austin by a year. My child was an infant and I was married during that time. And my ex-husband could pick up some of the slack. But I haven't had any family support. I mean, I've had a nice network of friends. I would say maybe this is one of the greatest misgivings of my life is that I have done everything on my own, probably because I had to, partially because I didn't know I had choices and I didn't know I could have help. Mostly because I feel pretty strongly, this is also a problem in my business. I know exactly how things should be done. It's very limiting having that kind of thinking. But the question, you know, how do you do it as a single mom? I get asked that question a lot. Honestly, I didn't know I had a choice to do anything other than what I did. You just play through. Yeah. And I think they credit Winston Churchill with the saying of, if you're going through hell, keep going. And that was kind of it. I have absolutely no complaints. I missed out on a lot of cool social stuff. I missed out on great interpersonal relationships and maybe some like really kick-ass sex with members of the opposite sex and things like that.
Did you choose just not to, you know, some people say, all right, I'm not gonna have another partner until my child is out of the house. Like, was that a choice that you made?
No, but it kind of chose me. So I have not lacked for male attention over the years, definitely. And I have dated people and I've been in long-term relationships and things like that. But then at the end of the day, what happens is, you know, something will happen where my child's needs or even the needs of my business or some combination thereof or my dog's needs or whatever, they prevail. I was looking for a partner through this, not looking for a dad for my kid and whatever. And, you know, I've learned a lot. I love men and I love the company of men. And I enjoy dating and I enjoy relationships and things like that. But what it comes down to often is men often feel emasculated by me, just because of the level of energy that I sustain and how
much
I have
a very strong personality. So
yeah, I don't mean that. I'm a tiny human being and I project this like 7 feet tall.
Yeah. And I don't mean that negative, by the way, when I say that. You just have a big personality. So you need a guy who is okay with being the back seat in maybe 95% of the situation. So like,
And so that sort of conflicts with this desire to be with somebody who can go toe to toe with me. Yeah. And when I say toe to toe, I mean, just be like intellectually keeping up and energetically keeping up and being interesting. You know, the last guy I dated, he drove me absolutely bonkers because I was the most interesting thing about our relationship and I don't want that either. Right. I don't want to overpower somebody. So it's been really hard. And then, you know, on one end you have those guys who have very fragile egos. If I don't talk to them for 2 or 3 days because I'm traveling for business or something and I have, you know, 10 minutes to like exchange a couple of text messages and maybe a quick like, hey, how you doing call, but I can't sit on the phone for, you know, 2 hours and wax poetically about, you know, how dreamy your eyes look
I always think that's a sign, right? So like my take on this is like, so my wife was the same way as you. That's how we met. I'm not saying I solved all of her problems. I think I've created more in the long term than I did at the time.
Yeah.
But she would never talk on the phone until we met. She would never do any of that stuff. But when it was the right mix, so she, you know, the guy before me was a pushover. Where do you want to go eat? Oh, I don't care.
Oh,
wherever
I
you
can't
want to
stand
go.
That. I yeah. can't stand
and
that.
So,
yeah.
So it drove her mad. And I mean, that's a bad example because I really am like, I don't really give a shit. But I also have a spine. I'll say I don't like that or that's not smart, or let's do this differently. And so I was the first guy she ever dated that had a stronger, more thought out process about the world just because of my experiences. And so my point is that if it is a guy you're really into, then you're going to make time for some of that stuff. If it's not a guy you're into, then you don't care. And maybe you're so accustomed to always just being able to do what Deb wants to do when Deb wants to do it, that maybe that's always kind of the square in the round hole, whatever that saying is, peg.
Yeah, square peg in a round hole. And so, yes, I think it is. I think you're right. And I think it's a combination of both. And, you know, I was in what I thought was a really great relationship where I did sort of slow down and relax into the relationship. And there was this sort of, you know, kind of egalitarian ebb and flow of energy in the relationship and romance and all that kind of stuff. And then he turned out to be a shit heel, which, you know, I'm still, honestly, I have to say, like, I'm still devastated by the result of this relationship. And basically it amounts to some untruths, we'll say. And I really, really value truth. So, And so it was bad. And the good news is, like, I'm not desperate. I'm not looking for a daddy, baby daddy, whatever that is. And all of that.
You want a partner. You want a partner that you can share experiences with. And I think that's fair. And that's probably what most people should want if they want a healthy relationship. So listen, I could talk about this for a while, but I've had you on and I need to do my fast five. And then I want to talk about your branding is sex book. So are you ready to do fast five?
Sure.
So question one, what was your first job ever?
So I worked at a hamburger / ice cream stand in Cincinnati, Ohio, and I worked there for total of 2 weeks. It was not Dairy Queen. It was called GD Ritzy's, and it was really gross. But I got fired for sending hamburgers through the drive-thru with no meat.
Was that just to rebel?
Yes, in protest that I had not yet been promoted to grill gal, and I was still cleaning the toilets and you know, just putting the sandwiches together, but not actually getting to touch anything hot.
So wait, how old were you, did you say?
I believe I was 15. And then as soon as I turned 16, I got fired from that job. And then I shortly thereafter turned 16. And then I worked at Kings Island for 7 years.
Well, I was just going to say, so even at 15, you were a shitster.
Yeah, totally.
All right. Question two, who do you admire most?
Either you.
Don't lie.
Nah. Who do I admire most, either professionally or personally?
It's up to you.
So I'm really, really admiring right now one of my key employees, which he's pretty fantastic. And I hope he doesn't listen to this because it's going to make his big head bigger. But I admire the poise and self-confidence this young man. I want to say he's like all of 27 years old. Just the poise and self-confidence he has. Like, I have kind of thrown him into a big time leadership role and put him in a place to sort of carve out his way without too much involvement, interference, direction from me, because I want to see how he, you know, he can build relationships and build a culture. And I just really, really, really admire the strength and sort of creativity and strategy that he shows in this role. And then I love how he's kind of he's the glue that holds our office together. And he's kind of like this anchoring part of our culture. And I really, really admire that.
Well, what's interesting is that's almost in contradiction to what you said earlier about having to be in control of everything, because you're giving this young man control of certain aspects of the business. Maybe it's not a massive aspect, but it is an aspect.
So it's interesting to me because I think one of the places where he's the most poised and self-confident is with the contradictory messages that he receives from me about, like, hey, I want you to handle this and I want you to, you know, be at the center of this and make these decisions and lead through this. And then I will, you know, it's sort of the seagull style of management. I swoop over, drop a big old load of shit on it. And, you know, he's a little bit like, the good news about him is he'll take me to task for it. He'll say, I thought you were asking me to, you were asking me to do this. You were asking me to step up and lead through this. But here you are, you know, trying to force a decision, which is it? So he keeps me honest. And, and I guess that's, you know, it's hard for both of us and it's getting better, but, I admire how well he deals with my schizophrenia.
Okay. Question three, what animal best represents your management style?
Well, I just said seagull, right? No. I know, but it's not, that is not really my management style.
No, I wouldn't buy that.
No, probably not. I'm not flying over and just like shitting all over everybody. Animal that best represents my management style. Australian cattle dog, which also coincidentally is the kind of dog I have at home.
Good, good. All right. Question four. What traits irritate you the most in your colleagues?
Oh, goodness. All right. So number one, lack of follow through. Mm-hmm. If I have to follow up with you, I'm going to, it's just going to get really, really under my skin. So keeping things moving, like maintaining momentum, bird dogging things, you know, things don't always happen immediately when you want them to happen. And if you're going to get them to happen, you have to have the fortitude and the perseverance to like keep them moving. So a lack of follow-up, if I have to ask for anything, I'll give, you know, I'll kind of give you one, it's sort of, you get one pass, right? But then if I have to ask you a second time, that's just going to make the top of my head explode. And then another thing, and you probably picked this up, just the facts, ma'am. I need hit the high notes. I am a huge big picture thinker. I am a strategist. I am not a tactician. I don't need to know all of the excruciating detail of how every piece of sausage is being made. I just want to eat the freaking cooked sausage. So the good news is I think the people who work here, they understand that about me and have done a really good job. We've done endless personality and work styles tests to learn how to work with each other and stuff. So that definitely helps, but I'm definitely not the in the details kind of person.
All right. Question five, what situations bring out the best in Deb?
Situations where, you know what, this is a trick question, James, honestly, because the situations that bring out the best in Deb also bring out the worst. So those are the ones where we're having sort of contentious relationships with clients or where there's just like a lot of stuff going on and everybody feels like they need to breathe into the paper bag. You know, when things get hectic and chaotic, that definitely brings out the best in me. At the same time, it brings out the worst in me because, you know, all of my great honed over 25 plus years of experience, you know, like all that stuff that I've been building on, it's like, oh, I finally get to use this, that all comes out. But then at the same time, like those deep seated sort of emotional ticks and those things come out too. So there you go.
That's awesome. All right. Well, thank you for doing Fast Five. Ready? And what I want to do is just spend the last 5 or 10 minutes and talk about your book, Branding is Sex, right?
Ooh, so yeah.
Even the language you use is sexual in describing the book, The Branding is Sex. It's a short, you call it a 7-chapter book. So yeah. I guess, what are you trying to accomplish by writing this book? Just to give people the down and dirty to branding?
So I am compelled to give this information away. I can't not do it. I think
why are you compelled? Isn't it your IP?
Like nothing about it is really IP, honestly. I feel I am driven to make other people successful in their businesses. I love to talk about people's ideas and their businesses or their own little sort of solopreneur kinds of things, or even people who are trying to kind of sell themselves to get a job opportunity or get a board position or something like that. You know, I feel I want people to be successful in their endeavors. And the way that I do that is by helping people connect the dots between the stories that their audience are trying to tell about themselves. So the stories of their lives, and then the story that they, you know, whoever is the brand, that company or that person or that job applicant or whatever, the story that they're telling. Like, I love to make those connections just because I am compelled to see other people be successful in their businesses. That's the whole reason I started this business. And that's the whole reason I wrote this book. So where the book came in was these methodologies that I created and sort of have honed over the second half of my career working hands-on with clients. I felt like other people could benefit from these, and I just needed to give them away. I had so much to say that I had to write the book. And the book is really designed to be a pretty practical nuts and bolts guide to branding. And
yeah, I don't see you being a fluffy, overly wordy person in this capacity.
Right. The whole idea was just to take it and really, really break it down. And that's where this idea of branding as sex comes from and why it's branding as sex. So over my career, I've worked a lot with technology companies and companies that are in just really, really complex, dynamic industries where there's just, there's a lot of nuts and bolts, literally and figuratively. And these are often organizations that are driven by engineers or developers or people who have a scientific background. And they didn't come at this from a marketing or communications background as, say, you did or I did. And what I learned was if I could just strip away all of the rhetoric and all of the bullshit and all of the, just like all of the extra stuff and get really, really specific with stuff that they could relate to, then I could create opportunities for them to succeed in ways that they couldn't otherwise. So where branding as sex comes from is really going through this sort of brand strategy process with clients when an engineer would glaze over and be like, I don't understand. Why are we doing this? Why do we need to bring the customer into the conversation? I don't get it. We have better technology than anybody else, and that should be enough. I could look at that person right in the eye and say, people buy things from people. At the end of the day, everybody has a customer who is a human being, whether you are making optical switches or you are selling jars of peanut butter, there are people buying these things. And our role as a brand is to figure out how do we make that person a hero in the story that they're creating for themselves. Ultimately, if you're selling ice to Eskimos, you have to think about what is the story of the Eskimo's life and how do you get the Eskimo laid? Because that's all he really wants out of life, right?
Well, and it sounds like what you're trying from there. It sounds like what you're trying to do is create value propositions that speak to the end user.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In the language of the end user, from the point of view of the end user, in terms of I am using this because it's going to make me a hero in this way. It says about me that I am smart. I am cool. I am savvy. I am a trailblazer.
Whatever the brand's trying to say, right?
Yes, so exactly.
Whatever their consumer is.
Yeah. So that's what the book is about, just really changing the conversation. And it gives in those seven chapters, it gives kind of step by step. Here are different things that you can do to kind of uncover what is the core DNA of your brand. And then how does your brand help your customers tell a story of success about themselves and create success for them? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, for me, yes, I think it does. So I guess what I was thinking, I'm kind of in this camp, but I kind of want to get your thoughts before I tell you which camp I'm in. Not that you're going to sway my camp, but still. What role do you think authenticity plays now in marketing?
I think it's becoming increasingly important. It's always been really important, and I think it's increasingly important. And authenticity to me, just so that we can make sure we're on the same page here, authenticity is really about being true to your promise and your core and your purpose and your reason for being and having a promise and delivering on that promise. That's really what authenticity means to me. Over the past couple of months, I became the world's resident authority on botched corporate apologies. Thanks Kendall Jenner and Pepsi and United Airlines and Fyre Festival. And I'm not kidding. I mean, I literally did probably 80 media interviews with top tier business and mainstream media, just talking about how inauthentic a lot of these corporate apologies and mm-hmm. and messages or action and inaction were. So authenticity is becoming increasingly important. Likewise, you know, in the world of branding, which is really what I'm paying attention to, brands have values, and people choose brands because those values align with their own. Totally. And so you and I come to the table with a set of beliefs and values and things that are important to us. And hopefully we are choosing brands because we can see that authentically they align with those values and beliefs that we have, and that, you know, that ultimately the brands are going to deliver on their promise.
Well, you know, like what's interesting about all of that is that, you know, I'm a big believer in, first of all, same camp as you then. So great news. We can share the fire.
Yay!
But I think that, like, you know, when you talk about values of the brand and aligning it with the end user, for me, you know, there's this concept, which I know you know it, you might use it by a different term, it's called brand engagement and self-concept. And essentially what mm-hmm. it's about is people buy brands that they see reflects who they are.
Absolutely. Those are, if you read my book, it's, you know, in the chapter called the Brand Values Pyramid, and it talks the top of the pyramid are the self-expressive benefits, the values and beliefs, and it says something about me. It's becoming increasingly important that brands remain true, authentically true to their values, especially as Gen Z comes of age and mm-hmm. starts to have money where they have increasingly more buying power.
So listen, I've had you on forever. So I have one more question for you, and then I'll let you run and do
okay.
your job. Deb Gabor, how do you, for where you're at in your life, how do you define happiness?
Well, happiness for me, let's see. It's interesting. Joy is the primary metric by which I measure the quality of my life. Happiness for me really comes from having the people around me. If everything is humming and we feel low discord and we are working through conflict and people are on a path to self-actualization, that makes me feel really, really freaking awesome. That and skiing. Those two things.
And so where can my audience find more about Deb and the book and other books on your website? But where else can
All
they
right.
get it?
Well, you could go to the brandingissex.com website. There's a little bit of information about the book and a link to go buy it. My company is online at soulmarketing.com. And feel free to follow me on Twitter. I'm at Deb_soul, S-O-L. Doesn't stand for shit out of luck. It's like the sun in Spanish. And I would love to hear from people. And, you know, if you have a branding question, or if you have a question about life, or you want to fix me up on a date with someone or whatever, feel free to reach out to me. You know where to find me.
And be careful on that last request.
I know, right?
Well, listen, Deb, thank you for your time, your energy, and your willingness to stop by Executives After Hours.
Well, this was awesome. Thank you so much. You ask amazing questions. This is a good in-depth interview, and you know, you really connected with me. So
thank you.
Really, really awesome. I enjoyed it.
I'll make sure to tell my mom to send you that paycheck.
Okay, great.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Thank you.